Session number 23848, Reel 21.
Mr. Wildgus, Reel 21. Right, Mr. Wildgus, we're talking about Basingstoke. And you're just saying that the ward was to be cleared out for D-Day. Mm. Before we talk about that, were there any other personalities and individuals that stand out amongst the patients and amongst the staff at Basingstoke?
Well, there was a chappy called Yulton. He'd had his nose blown off, and they did what was known as a pedicle, when they took the scalp off, rolled it up into a sausage, and then swing it down to the nose where it's joined, stitched on, until it grows more flesh. So poor old Alton looked like an elephant with the trunk full of, covered in hair, of course, because the hair grows eventually, although they shave it off. There was another chappie who'd, he was a civilian who'd done a lot of metal work and brazing and that type of thing, and they reckon that the acid had got underneath his visor and had formed a tumour behind his forehead. So they'd had to cut out a circle of bone, remove the tumour, and of course the head went in. So he used to have a tennis ball put into this hole, and then a bandage around it when he went on leave, in case he scared the neighbours. But he was back on, he showed me photographs of the stages through the operation, and of course it's surprising how different a man looks, for instance, when he hadn't got any eyebrows or hadn't got any eyelashes, and certainly when he'd got a really great hole in the middle of his skull. The thing that often happened were fractured cheekbones due to traffic accidents, particularly in jeeps, men who fell asleep and hit a telegraph pole. Gillis had performed or perfected a new approach to that by sort of probing under the skin with wire, pushing the bone forward back into position, and then telling them not to touch it, and in most cases it healed back almost as it was naturally. But most of them were facial disfigurements, really. I mean, mine was minor. I mean, I could have got away with it, but he was so pleased. In fact, when he came round with another consultant, he said, you know, I could make that even better if I did it under X-ray. I don't quite know what he meant, because there was one scar that was slightly wider than another one. But I was fortunate in having very quick healing skin, and I seemed to heal much quicker than many of them did. And of course, if the skin didn't take, as it in many cases didn't, you finished up then with double the amount of scarring that you had to begin with. A friend of mine was wounded in Italy, and he lost his nose and ears, and when they operated on him using this pedicle business, they didn't take, so he finished up with more scars on his face than he started with, and the rest of his life he looked a mess. But I didn't see, not there, many burns. They didn't get them quite so much in the army. They did after D-Day, they did a lot of tank things, but most of them were look attable in a way.
Were you happy with the standard of the treatment and so on that you were seeing?
We didn't know whether it was good, bad or indifferent, we just accepted it. It's rather funny, because I was in the hospital a couple of years ago, and it's taken me all this time to realise it. I said to the nurse, you know, I said, when I was last in hospital for a long time, I said, all the patients were young and all the nurses were young. I said, now when you go to hospital, all the patients are old and the nurses are young. And I said, we had a hell of a good time when we were young and the nurses were young. But, it's surprising the difference. It never occurred to me, you see, that from then on, everybody in hospital was young, but now they're all old. And so there's a different atmosphere. I mean,
Now, you were flirting,
you know.
Was that tolerated by the authorities, to flirt with
nurses? Oh, I think so. Yes, I mean, it was accepted. Talking about bad wounds, when I went back off leave once, there was another chappie there, he said, "What are you in for?" So I told him wound. And I said, "What about you?" He said, "The worst." So I said, "What's happened then?" And he was at the Battle of the Barrath Line. And he'd fetched a wounded bloke back. And he went back again and he stood with his legs apart, and a mortar bomb exploded and removed 1.5 testicles and part of his penis. And he said, "They've come in to see if they can do anything for me." He said, "When I was in Africa, they did a grafting job, and he said, they advised me to sort of heal it dry in the sun." And he said, "Of course, the sun has made it even worse. And so I've come to see what they can do here." He said, "The trouble is," he said, I've lost all my hair on my body." He said, "All that's gone." And he said, "Going out with women, I might as well go out with a man." He said, "I've got no sort of sexual feelings." And he went through a very rigorous time. They put both his legs in plaster so he couldn't move, and then they did a bit of grafting around those parts, and they used him as a guinea pig. He said, afterward I met him, he said, the nurses and staff used to come round to see what was going on and the rest of it. And next time I went in hospital, he got engaged to an Irish nurse. Now, I think the Irish nurse really only wanted security. He did tell me that at the time. He said he was a good pianist, and he said, "I never wanted to get my hands damaged in case I couldn't play." So he said, "At least I could still play the piano." But when I met him on a reunion some years later, his wife had gone to the dance part, and he hadn't, and I think he was working out up to a point, but it wasn't exactly satisfactory, and they never were able to sort of reconstruct him in any particularly good way. Once or twice, there was one case in Africa I heard of the same thing had happened, and in fact it happened quite often. You don't think it does, but apparently it does. And I was always relieved that there weren't many inches away from me, but it did go through my mind at the time when I was wounded. I wonder what the next thing's going to happen, or next thing you're going to hit. But they did a very varied type of job. As far as D-Day was concerned, of course, we spent a lot of the time rolling bandages and preparing dressings. It gave you something to do. And
so you were helping the staff with that?
Yes, yeah. And they'd anticipated thousands of casualties, really, literally. They expected the place to be overrun with them. In the event D-Day came and went, a friend of mine who went on D-Day came to see him in hospital. 3 weeks later, I was going to see him in hospital. He was wounded in France. And after...
Can you remember his name?
Phil Branson. He comes from Nottingham. He's still alive. His birthday was D-Day. And I always ring him up, or generally ring him up on D-Day, on his birthday. He was 22 on his birthday. So,
and what unit was he with?
He was with the East Yorks, 50 Div. Time to tease, wasn't it? As he came to see me there, and it's funny, we went out for a drink, and there were tanks past you within about a foot, and of course the whole of the South of England was one great ammunition dump. I mean, there were tanks and there were ammunition stored along the roads, and as I say, when we were in this pub in May, in May 1944, it was just solid with the vehicles, and with 50 Div, a lot of them had come back from the Western Desert, and although they said that they put them in cages so that the public couldn't get in, for security, they really put him in cages to stop him getting out, he said, because he'd never experienced the war, the action, and it was a bit...
No, we're talking about D-Day.
Yes, D-Day and this friend of mine was... he's not worried, but I mean, he knew that he had to sort of command men who had, majority of them had seen action before and were rather loath to go over, despite what the papers said at the time, that these men were willing and looking forward to the great adventure.
Now, had he been in action before?
No, he hadn't.
And were you able... Did you give him any advice about, from your experiences, of maybe what to do and what not to do, what to do right?
I don't think I did. I suppose one didn't even keep your head down, because I mean I knew that he wouldn't be able to, and of course he didn't. And like most officers, he got wounded a few weeks, like myself. I'd met him at Sandhurst, actually, as well, by a strange coincidence. We'd gone down there together on a train, and he was in the Royal Armoured Corps. He was commissioned into the Royal Armoured Corps. He hadn't been in those 3 months, and they transferred him to the Royal Artillery. He then went on a course for the Royal Artillery, and no sooner had he finished that course than they said, we need more infantry officers. So he was and he said, The Armour Corps was bad enough, he said, but after the Armour Corps, the Royal Artillery was absolute hell, and he said the infantry was even worse, he said. I couldn't believe it, but he said, I'm glad I served in the infantry, he said, because they are the real soldiers, and but he said, I'd never realised just how the physical strain you have to encounter in the infantry compared to the other arms. Because I saw him over a period before this last meeting in...
Was he able to tell you about... I mean, obviously, with all this equipment, you'd be aware that this D-Day was going to happen.
Oh, yes, they were. They knew it was going to happen.
Did you have an idea of when it was going to be from him? Or was it?
Well, we knew, because they were clearing the decks. I mean, that was the biggest indication. And, of course, the amount of equipment there was. I mean, up here, all Sherwood Forest was an ammunition dump. There were railway lines through it, and these roads had ammunition along the side. I don't know what they do today. It seemed to be blowing each other up. But the road to Leicester, the Fossway, had been made dual carriageway just before the war. It was never used during the war. It was used as a vehicle park and ammunition dump, you see.
You've mentioned... during your time at Machurchy, just backtracking a little bit, when you were managing to get out a little bit with Jimmy Hanley.
Yeah.
Now, you were, at this stage of the war, you mentioned earlier, lots of Americans and so on.
Yeah.
Could you just give us some impressions of your social life at that time? You were just getting mobile again, and what you thought possibly of all of these... the impact of the Americans on the social life.
I got quite a lot. Twice when I was at Chelsea, I got sort of 10 weeks leave, or they said go on leave for 8 weeks or 10 weeks, and the same at Basingstoke. And I used to come home and meet whatever friends there were, and go to the pictures. I remember, for instance, going to Piccadilly. I finished up Piccadilly Circus one night at the Underground, and I didn't know what the heck to do. It's all right during the day, but as soon as the evening comes, and there was a naval officer hanging around. Now, the strange thing, today you couldn't do it. You'd be arrested. And he was obviously... I thought, well, he'd been there a long while, and I didn't know what to do. So I went up to him, and I said, are you doing anything? And he said, no. He said, I'm waiting for something. He said, if they don't come, we'll go out and have a drink. So he gave him another 5 minutes, said, all right, we'll go. And we went up. We'd never met each other. We picked up a couple of ATS girls, or WAFs. We went out and drank and then went our way and never considered that there was any ulterior motive. I remember they used to have trade shows at the cinema. They used to show these films prior to distribution into the provinces, and they were held in the morning at the local cinema, and I got a couple of tickets for the cinema in Nottingham. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I saw an American coming towards me, and I stopped him. I said, are you doing anything? And he said, no. I said, well, I got two tickets for the cinema. Do you want to come? So he said, sure. So we went to the cinema, and then when we came out, I took him home, and we had some sort of a meal. And then we went over to a friend, a pub, out of town, and were there all night. Then he got a taxi, and we came back, and that was the end of that day. His name was Heron. I don't know whether he was in the air. I think he was in the army. I never saw him again, and yet we spent quite an enjoyable day. But nowadays, you know, say if you stood outside of a cinema and he stopped a bloke and said, you want to come in, then probably call the police, wouldn't they?
What kind of place was London at this time?
London.
To go out for a night out?
I remember going out, the first time I went through London when I was commissioned, I was accosted three times by ladies of the night, and I was so naive, I didn't even know what they wanted. Although I thought I was, what jolly decent girls these are. I mean, they even, well, I was in Nottingham with chasing around trying to find them, they came to you in London. And when I said, I've got to catch a train, and they said, OK, you've got to catch a train. And that was the end of that. I think it took me 3 years before I realised what had happened. We went on a... prior to going abroad, I went on a street fighting course in the East End of London, and I went up to Piccadilly Circus one night. A girl stopped me for a light. I didn't realise they asked you for a light so they could see what you looked like in light. And she was a very attractive blonde. But I took her as an attractive girl, never entered my head that she was on the game. And we had quite a pleasant evening. I think I could have converted her to the passive righteousness. And we arranged, I said, well, we'll go to a cinema tomorrow night in Leicester Square. And when I got back, the chap said, oh, you don't want to... Oh, don't go with her, come out with her. So I went out with them, and that was the end of that. But London, it wasn't until 1940, end of 45, that I went to London and even experienced a V2 landed, I think, one night. But I was never accounted a bombing raid. In fact, in the West End of London, of course, you didn't look for it, but I never remember seeing much damage at all. In fact, I don't remember seeing any damage whatsoever. It just carried on normally. I suppose that by today's standards, even by today's standards, the journey times were longer. But because you were used to long, slow trains, it was quite normal. We had a ruse whereby if you were, say, south of London and wanted to go to Nottingham, you'd get a railway pass for Newcastle-on-Tyne. You say, I'm going to leave Newcastle-on-Tyne. The army, apparently, or the services, paid the railways, I believe it was 10 shillings per ticket, irrespective of where they went to, you see. So you'd ask for a leave ticket to Newcastle-on-Tyne, and then you get off at Nottingham, and then you could use the other bit later on, or you'd break your journey in London, and then you could use the other bit for another journey later on, you see. And then we used to alter the leave passes with ink eradicator and rewrite your destinations, and they were so obvious. I mean, looking at, I had one little while, I looked at it, I thought, well, it's so obvious when you had showed that to a guard, an inspector, that just used, I bet they thought, crikey, a dumb lot. But there were ways and means. I mean, you'd get on some trains full of troops, and the train would put into a platform, and more people got out the other side than got out on the platform because they hadn't got tickets or didn't work it. But I went to London, I suppose, quite regularly, but mainly to pass through. And as I say, it's not the friendliest of places unless you've got somebody there to meet or, you know, be entertained with. And it was quite expensive as well compared with Nottingham.
Did Jimmy Hanley introduce you to anybody interested in any of his kind of...
No, I did see him once more in Chertsey. Diana Sheridan, that was his wife's name. And she came along with her son, who was the Hanley, was the MP. Who became an MP recently. But their marriage broke up very quickly, actually, certainly after the war. And she remarried, I don't know how many times, and she was acting until very recently. But of course, she'd got to be 80. Now, I think 80 odd, but she was the most glamorous. She used to disport herself in the grounds of Sandhurst, sort of reclining on the balustrade and in elegant fashion, you know, on a Sunday morning. And everybody looked at her with lascivious eyes and thoughts. But apparently, she was a bit of a hard nut in real life.
Now,
no, he didn't.
Now, you were at Basingstoke. You'd had these operations. Mm. Now, at what stage did the army kind of assess your injuries? Mm. Had they assessed them previous to this, or was there an assessment?
Well, the next thing I had was Gillis said, "Well, you ought to have your arm grafted." So I had my arm grafted. And that means I was adjoined to my skin on my abdomen for about a fortnight. The skin made into a flap and it's stitched onto your arm, and then they cut it off and trim it up. And when that was done, representatives from the War Office came round to interview you. And they said, "Well, you've been now... I'm sick for nearly 18 months, and 18 months is the deadline before you're discharged." And he said, "Shake hands with me." Well, I had no grip. And he said, "That's a bit bad." And they left it at that. Then I got a letter to report to the War Office for medical medical assessment. And... Well, within a fortnight, my hand was back to normal again. I could, it was never quite normal, but I got a good grip and enough. And I went back to Whitehall, to the War Office there, and was interviewed, and they said, "You know, we discharge you automatically after 18 months. Any objections?" So I said, "Yes, I don't want to be discharged from the army." And they said, "Why?" I said, "Well, the war's still on, and I haven't really anything to go back for. I haven't a job." And he said, "Can I feel your hand?" And he said, "Oh, that's strength," he said, "very good. So if you want to stay in the army," he said, "we'll make sure you stay in the army," he said, "but we won't expect you to take active service again. We'll give you an administrative job." And he said, "We'll post you to the Sherwood Forest Holding Battalion in Nottingham at a place called Watton in the Vale on the way to Grantham." And I was duly sent home. I think when the treatment was completed, I was sent home to await posting. And this was in September 1944. And when I got my posting to the Sherwood Forest's Holding Battalion, it had moved and gone up to Northumberland again, to Morpeth, 11th York and Lancs. And so duly I left Nottingham and went up to Morpeth in October 1944. And eventually, after a rather traumatic journey, I finished up in but it's called Nunnykirk, which is near Long Horsley, which is near Nether Witton, which is 10 miles from Morpeth. And
how was it a traumatic journey?
Hmm?
How was it traumatic?
Well, it was traumatic in as much as I arrived in Morpeth at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on this horrible winter day, and rang out for a truck, and they said you'll have to wait for the leave truck, and I waited until 11 o'clock at night. Got on in the dark, went around all the villages of Northumberland talking to an officer who'd got in, who said, well, the best thing for you to do is to come and sleep with me in my room tonight and see what happens in the morning. And so this journey went on from all these outstations. We eventually arrived at Nunnykirk Hall about 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning, went into this hall that hadn't any electricity at the time, or wasn't switched on. We went to his room, he lit a candle, and he said, good God, it's you. And it was the same chap he had met in Yarmouth, who'd been posted abroad, the one I told you about who got a bit bomb happy. And he'd recently come out of hospital himself. We'd both been in the First Army, and we stayed up there. Well, I stayed up there a year afterwards.
Could you just describe? I think you explained off the tape what this York and Lancs Battalion was.
Well, the York and Lancs Battalion, when I got there in the morning, and went to see the CO. There was the officer who joined the 16th Battalion with me, Millard. There was Ingram, second in command, who had been in Nottingham in 1940. There was the MT sergeant, who had been the MT sergeant in Nottingham in 1940. There were the cooks. There was a fellow called Hood, who was the adjutant, who had been in 1940, who'd been with me in the 70th Battalion, actually. And all of them had somehow hung on to their jobs for 4 years. And it was an amalgamation of the Foresters, Lincolns and York and Lancs. And it was a training battalion where we had intakes in for training prior to being posted overseas. The unfortunate thing was that everybody who did the training had never been out of the country, and all the administrative staff, including NCOs who were quartermaster sergeants, and the administrative officers, which was a new rank they brought in, which I was administrative officer E Company, this friend Cox was administrative officer F Company, were all had seen service, and a lot of the intakes didn't like it. The only time when any of them showed a bit of insubordination was when they were ordered to do things by sergeants or officers who hadn't got any medals up, as they said. And it became a bit cliquey, and it became a little bit stressed at times that we who had seen action in one form or another were being told what to do by people who'd hung around in England for the last 4 years who were had superior ranks. So there was a bit of an atmosphere on many occasions, and more bolshy that we were, as we were, a lot of us, the more the tension grew.
What about the commanding officer of the unit? Who was that?
The commanding officer was a fellow called Robins. He'd been captured for a short time, but he certainly hadn't seen any action. And he left, and we got a commanding officer, I can't remember now, but he'd been a prisoner of war and had experienced nothing of the army from before the war. He was captured quite early on, and he'd been released. I don't know how. It was probably when Italy capitulated and that war had finished to a large extent. And he came to commander battalion and had no...